a very Buddhist topic, and that is the notion of going for refuge. Historically, down through the ages, Buddhists have dedicated themselves to the Buddhist path, to Buddhist practice, to the Buddha Dharma, in a particular ritual, heartfelt orientation that's called going for refuge. And it's a going for refuge in what's called the three refuges, or the triple refuge, or the triple gems. And they are refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dharma, and refuge in the Sangha. And it kind of, the triple refuge kind of encapsulates the whole orientation of a spiritual life. For some Buddhists, the central orienting principle for their lives, they're going to orient their lives around what's symbolized or encapsulated in the triple refuge. They're going to get their sense of meaning for their life from the idea of a triple refuge. It gives them some sense of what they're, where, you know, how they can engage in a life which is often out of control. At times of great crisis, a personal crisis, social crisis, traditionally Buddhists, what they do is they go for refuge, or they take refuge, or they get they find their inspiration from the triple refuge. And over the last couple of months, I've had more people raise deeper kind of existential questions than almost any time that I've been teaching. And people who want to understand about the nature of good and evil, people who want to understand, you know, what's the meaning of their life, what's the meaning given the kind of crises that can happen, that happens around us. How do we respond, or how do we react, or how do we deal with crisis after crisis? I know people who somehow have a fairly good way of coping or relating to the first or second crisis, but after a while it seems like it's ongoing day after day, and it's the Bay Bridges, and it's the mail, and just, you know, airlines left and right, and it just seems to be never ending. At some point, the feeling that, you know, this is out of control. I thought I had something to do. I knew what to do with my practice. I knew kind of what I could do to kind of maybe try to help a little bit. But it's gotten out of control, and people get very afraid when it gets to the point that it's seemingly out of control. I know people have expressed a lot of fear. And traditionally, what Buddhists have leaned on or gone towards or been inspired by in moments of crisis has been the triple refuge. And it's fairly common for Buddhists then to do it both personally, very privately in their own hearts, kind of remember the refuge and remember that's their orientation, but also sometimes to do it in a ritual fashion, a ceremony or celebration, to go to a monastery or a temple and participate in sometimes quite formal refuge ceremonies. And some people, when they encounter Buddhism, have a very intellectual interest in it. Well, they often, a lot of Westerners, that's kind of the first avenue of our interest in Buddhist practice. We read Dharma books, we read books on Buddhism, and we grapple with the ideas, and some of them seem very logical, very straightforward, and very helpful. But often it's a somewhat intellectual orientation, and which maybe that's the way it should be for many of us. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you go to Southeast Asia, where you find a large pool of Buddhist practitioners and Buddhists, what you see is that their primary orientation towards their Buddhist practice is not intellectual, but is something that's heartfelt. And it's lovely to meet the heart, encounter this heartfelt sphere, field of people who are inspired and moved and emotionally moved by their encounter, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, with the Buddha, the teachings, and the community of people who practice. And some people in the West can get a little bit frightened or turned off by the emotional side of it, because it seems like it's a faith side. And some people have been quite discouraged by some of the ways in which faith has been handled in the West, in theistic religions, where sometimes your faith means you're supposed to believe in a particular creed, and you're either inside that creed or not inside that creed, and you have to believe in something which maybe seems doesn't quite make sense for you, and it's difficult to want to accept. But perhaps it's a little bit easier to understand faith in Buddhism if we understand faith as being that which gives our Buddhist practice a heartfelt quality. So it's not just simply understanding some good principles, but we can place our heart in it. We hold it in our heart. We are inspired, we're moved in more than just intellectual ways. Faith has a quality of confidence. Where do you put your confidence? What do you have confidence in times of great crisis? When you're on your deathbed, for example, you're dying. Where's your confidence? Where's your heart? Where do you place your heart? What's important for you? So the heartfelt quality is very important. And traditionally in Buddhists in Asia, the heartfelt quality of their practice is often encapsulated in this idea of the Triple Refuge. There's a peculiar translation into English of the refuge. The formula for going for refuge in Pali is Buddham Saranam Gacchami, and the same thing for Dharma and Sangha. So Dharma Saranam Gacchami and Sangha Saranam Gacchami. So the first Buddha is the Buddha, and it most literally, most overtly refers to the historical Buddha. The second Dharma refers to, most overtly, refers to the historical teachings and the practices that he taught. And the third, the Sangha, refers to those people, has actually two traditional meanings. One meaning are those people, any people at all, who have personally verified for themselves the truth of what the Buddha was trying to point to. Personally realize some level of, not that they understand the creed as being true, but rather they've realized the possibility of transforming the heart, transforming the mind, so that it's no longer driven by compulsive greed or hate or fear, and discovered some liberation, some transcendence from fear and hate, greed, transcendence from self-preoccupation. So that's on one hand, Sangha means anybody who has witnessed that, who's actually attained that kind of transformation, that kind of realization. It also refers to the monastic community of Buddhists. Because it's traditionally understood that the monastic community is the ones who are trying to live the lifestyle that's most conducive and most helpful to preserving the Dharma down through the ages. So it isn't that the monastic community is better than the lay community of practitioners, but just that historically it's been the fact that they've been the kind of the preservers of the tradition. They've maintained it over the centuries, and the lifestyle they live somehow expresses so much of the Dharma in it that they become the best carriers for it. So the traditional formulation is Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, Sangha Saranam Gacchami. And this has been translated often into English as I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, and I take refuge in the Sangha. However, the verb in Saranam Gacchami does not say take. It's Gacchami, and Gacchami is a very simple, mundane, obvious Pali word which means to walk, to go. So literally the translation is I go for refuge in the Buddha. I go for refuge in the Dharma. I walk. There's an action involved where you kind of lead yourself in that direction. And maybe it's being a little bit too petty to harp on this distinction between taking and going. But there's sometimes a tendency for us to appropriate Buddhism, kind of to grab it and hold on to it and use it to kind of prop up the self. And I've known plenty of Buddhists, the practitioners in the West, who have taken on their Buddhism as just another identity, and they get all the kind of right Buddhist garb and clothes and beads, and you know, they want to make sure everybody sees them as a good Buddhist, you know. And, you know, some Buddhism is something you take and appropriate for your own kind of self-serving purposes. To go for refuge involves, it's not just simply taking something, appropriating something, and adding it to yourself, but to go for refuge requires something of you, that you have to take some steps, you have to kind of apply yourself, enter into some new mode of being, some new orientation. There's something's required of you. And I think that's a very important thing to see in Buddhist spirituality, that something is required of you. So it isn't simply just a philosophy or a creed or a belief system that offers some hope or some positive way of looking at life or some explanation for the crises of our lives, so we have a good understanding of it, so now I understand it's under control and I can proceed with my life because I understand everything. It's not just simply an understanding, it's something you have to do, you have to put yourself into it. Put yourself, put your heart into it, put part of yourself into it. You have to extend yourself in some way. So what way is that? So for that, perhaps we need to look at what the triple refuge means a little more carefully. So, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, I take refuge in the Buddha. The Buddha, taking refuge in the Buddha does not mean taking literally refuge in the man, the person, the Buddha. But rather, you take refuge in the Buddha because of the awakening that he experienced, because of liberation that he was able to accomplish. That there was something that he managed to do, something that he touched or tastes or some way he was transformed that made him the Buddha. And take refuge in the Buddha is to take refuge in that possibility of transformation, in that transformation, in that radical transformation that makes someone a Buddha. And what is that? What makes a Buddha, as I understand it, as it's kind of come down to me from my teachers, is that it's someone who has succeeded in uprooting from their heart or from their minds those forces within them that are the basis for greed, the basis for hate, and the basis for delusion. Those forces within us that lead us to cause suffering to ourselves. One of the kind of jokes that sometimes is said about the refuge, you ask, refuges are kind of a protection. The triple protection. The question is, what are you being protected from? What is a refuge from? And the answer is from yourself. Because the recognition in Buddhism is that there's a tremendous amount of harm that we cause ourselves by the way in which we relate to ourselves and the world around us. And the place where we can take some responsibility and the place where we have some choice is how do we relate to what happens to us in our lives. We can't be sure about what's going to happen to the airplane we go flying in. And maybe it seems in a great crisis, the plane is going down, that maybe it seems like you can't do much. But the radical and very challenging teachings of the Buddha is that even in great moments of crisis, you're responsible for how you relate to that. And hopefully you have the presence of mind to see that place of choice so you can be responsible for how you're relating to the situation. So a Buddha is someone who's seen this possibility down to its root, the possibility of looking at the place of personal choice and found out how to uproot all of his tendencies towards compulsive behavior. All his tendencies towards fear, greed, hate. So someone might say, well, that doesn't seem like a very lofty spiritual goal, just to be freed of mundane things like greed, hate, and delusion, and fear. I mean, I'd rather, sit in great infinite white light and sit, have, communion with God or realize the oneness of everything. And there's all these great, more lofty things to be done. So, maybe Buddhism is just a poor religion, doesn't have much to offer. But the suggestion is that experience of is very radical. And perhaps the state that results when there's no more compulsive forces of greed, hate, and delusion, fear, it's often the language that's used is that it's lokottara, world transcending, it's supra mundane kind of an experience. It's kind of beyond the experience of our small self, our egotistical self, the self that we define by ourselves, that we protect and make ourselves. So when we take refuge in the Buddha, it's not just simply a refuge in the historical person, but rather in that which made the Buddha, his awakening, his experience. And for Buddhists, it might be an act of faith, it might be blind faith to some degree. I mean, how do we know that the Buddha really attained such a radical transformation? How do we know? I mean, religions are very good at having all kinds of fantastic ideals, seemingly mythic ideals at some times. And is a Buddha's attainment just another mythical ideal, some ideal of human perfection, that it's possible to completely eradicate greed, hate, and delusion from the mind? And it's just a myth. I mean, it can't really be done. But, you know, Buddhists are inspired by that myth, and they're moved by it and oriented towards it. But, you know, it's just a myth. How do we know? I don't know how to answer that question very well, but I'll answer it the best I can for myself. And that is, the simple answer is it's possible to have personal glimpses that suggest that this is possible, it's theoretically possible for a human being to do this work. And what a Buddha is, since it's theoretically possible, the Buddha represents at least, maybe it's mythical, but Buddha represents our capacity to fulfill that theory. So whether the Buddha actually existed or not, the Buddha represents the culmination or the fulfillment of what we've gotten the glimpse of. So now an analogy. I think at Portola Valley, where we meet on Sunday mornings, there's linoleum tiles on the floor, square, 1 foot square tiles. So imagine that no one cleaned that floor for about 100 years or more. And so all these Saturday night parties they have there, and the beer and the popcorn and stuff, you know, just kind of builds over the decades. You know, there's all this gunk and stuff, you know, it's maybe 6 inches thick by end of the century. And somehow, you've told, you know, your parents carried with them this idea that they learned from their parents that actually, that floor used to be shining and clean. And your parents never saw it, but you hear this rumor that underneath all that dirt is this beautifully shining, clear linoleum floor. And you say, well, it's just a myth, you know, who believes that kind of myth? It's just, you know, dirt. So then someone occurs to someone, well, let's do the work, and let's kind of clean, start cleaning the floor. And what they do is they clean 1 square foot of the floor. And it takes a while to do that, but they kind of scrape away and chip away and with explosives and stuff, and slowly they find their way to the bottom. And lo and behold, they find this, you know, linoleum floor, and they find they clean out 1 square foot of it, and they polish it, and it looks, wow, it's really clean, it really was there. You know, oh, I really see what's there. And now I know, in theory at least, that I could do that with the whole floor and get a whole clean linoleum floor. So what happens is that Buddhists can have a glimpse through practice of at least 1 square foot of the floor. And then they can be absolutely convinced that it can be done much more thoroughly. And then the practice becomes house cleaning, extending that and making it bigger and bigger, making that realization bigger and bigger, wider and wider throughout your mind and your heart and your life. So whether the Buddha was real in the sense of did he actually perfect himself in this way? Did he clean his whole floor or not? For me personally, is not as important as that he represents the possibility of doing that all the way. And, you know, I feel like I've gotten a glimpse of the floor, and so I feel quite confident that I feel like I'm just a beginner in many ways in the practice, but I'm quite confident that the floor can be cleaned. And I'm very inspired by that possibility. And I'm inspired by those people who've done a lot of this work. I don't know if I've ever met anyone who's cleaned their whole floor, but I've certainly met people who've cleaned a lot of it. And I'm very inspired by that. And I'm very inspired by the possibility that the Buddha was perhaps a person who'd cleaned the whole floor. And if he didn't clean the whole floor, then I'm just happy, I'm content to keep that as a representation of what's possible. It's something that I work towards. So Buddhists, I think, when they take refuge, take heart, they take inspiration, they take an orientation from the Buddha as someone representing the possibility of awakening. The Dharma is traditionally understood as being the teachings, but also the practices, those practices which lead a person to realize what the teachings are all about. The teachings in and of themselves are not that interesting, not any more interesting than a menu or, you know, a recipe in a cookbook. I mean, you can go to restaurants and admire the menu for a long time, and it's not going to help your hunger. Sooner or later, you have to order the food. You have to cook the recipe or something. So the Dharma as a teaching is not so interesting in and of itself unless we put it into practice. So the teachings and the practices are the Dharma. Dharma is also understood to be a little bit more than just the teachings and the practices. The Dharma is also understood to be the causal nexus, the cause and effect world that we find ourselves in. The Buddha emphasized a lot that it's very important to appreciate that we live in a world of cause and effect, and that what we do has an effect, that our actions don't just happen in a vacuum, but actually our actions have traces, have consequences beyond the present moment, beyond our immediate situation we find ourselves in. And if we follow the Dharma, or say if we follow a wholesome life, a life which is concerned with being good and helpful to people and helpful to ourselves, sensitive to the welfare of ourselves and sensitive to the welfare of others, that we enter into, some Buddhists use the word lawful, a lawful chain of cause and effect that leads to beneficial results. If we do things which are unwholesome, then the Dharma, the lawful process of cause and effect, will lead to unwholesome results, to detrimental results in our lives. So this is the law of karma. And for some Buddhists, if you look at the way some Buddhists relate to karma, it seems to be metaphysical, it seems to be an act of faith. It doesn't have to be that way, but it refers to the chain and cause and effect that our actions participate in. And part of taking refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha for Buddhists is to be conscious of karma, be conscious that what they do has consequences in the future. And if you want to set up the conditions for your own welfare, you have to be concerned with creating the right soil for that. You're going to plant the right seeds if you want to have the right kind of flowers. If you plant the seeds for bindweed, you know, you'll be unhappy later and you're trying to have a garden. But if you plant the seeds for sunflowers or roses, then you get the right results. So take refuge in the Dharma also means take refuge in the fruit of practice, the flowers that get born. And there are fruits to the practice. There's actually a possibility to feel experiences of liberation, of release, of compassion and love that come when these forces of compulsion in the heart are lessened and uprooted. So this is one of the things that traditionally Buddhists have a tremendous faith in, this possibility of the Dharma. The third refuge, the Sangha, is, as I said earlier, first and foremost, take refuge, take inspiration from those people who witnessed this possibility in themselves. That there are people in the world who have tasted the fruit of what practice has to offer. That the practice of Buddhism, vipassana, and meditation, and ethics, and loving kindness, can be done for its own sake. But it also involves being involved in a path, and that path has a particular end. And that end is when you get down and see the clean floor at the bottom. You get all the dirt away. And maybe you just, maybe the end, you know, in a sense, if you do 1 square foot of the dirty floor, the end, one end is just when you get down to the floor and you see the linoleum. And then you have to do it again. So it's kind of like, it's an endless process in a sense as you spread out and clean the whole floor. But there is a particular end. You don't go below the floor once you've got the floor clean. Does that make sense? So the path of vipassana has an end to it, even though you might have to go and do it over and over again as you spread out the realization beyond its initial domain. I think it's almost impossible to practice Buddhist practice, Buddhist spirituality alone. And I think that's what Buddhist tradition itself has suggested, that it's impossible to practice alone. And the way they do this is maybe a little bit vague, or is they say that the claim is made, I don't know if this is true at all, but this is the claim, is that if you manage to get fully enlightened by yourself, without the help of anybody else, you won't be able to teach it to anyone else. So you become what's called a pratyeka Buddha, a solitary Buddha. You go off and live in the woods by yourself then, and you can't teach it to anyone else. What I found in my own practice is that I could not have practiced over these years I've been practicing without the support of other practitioners, without the support of my teachers, without the support of my fellow practitioners who were there alongside, encouraging me and reflecting back at me and teaching me and correcting me as I went along. So for me, I take tremendous heart and inspiration in the community, in the sangha of people who I have practiced with and learned from. I find tremendous inspiration from the very simple arithmetic that tells me that there's only 100 generations between me and the Buddha, between us and the Buddha. And I don't know how many people are here in the room, but maybe 80, 90, 100 people here in the room. So if you lined up all these people in this room kind of in a row, generations going back in time, we would have a living connection to the Buddha. We wouldn't need more people than we have in this room to have a living connection back to the Buddha, one person after the other. And so much of the Buddha Dharma, of the Buddhist practice, comes from human connections, comes from knowing people who've practiced, and other people who've practiced, and teachers. And those teachers, those practitioners have got it from their teachers and their teachers. And as Suzuki Roshi said, Buddhism is transmitted from warm hand to warm hand. A very nice expression, from warm hand to warm hand. Not from Dharma book to Dharma book. That there's something very precious and maybe essential that happens in the human connection between people in the transmission of Buddhism. Maybe more than just simply the inspiration and the encouragement and the corrections and help that we get along the way. But maybe some of the very human qualities of love and compassion and peace are somehow resonating between people. Perhaps if you encounter someone who's filled with love or peace or free themselves of conflict, and they see it in that person, it resonates with you, something inside of yourself. Because that's a possibility we all have. All of us in our own hearts have the possibility of having this peace, free from conflict, free from fear, to be free of hate, free of greed. And in that, it's already a possibility, a potential within us. When we see it in others, I think it resonates, speaks to us. what's coming to mind as I say this, when I was just beginning my kind of residential practice at the San Francisco Zen Center, I was working at the Tassajara Bakery. Maybe some of you know about this bakery. I was a kind of, I was just working in the back, helping with the baking bread and stuff. And one day I was up in the office, and the manager of the bakery was there with me, and he opened his letter, and he read to me the letter that he'd just gotten. It was a short little letter. It was a fundraising letter for some local neighborhood cause. I don't remember what it was. And I guess they sent fundraising letters to local businesses asking if they would help. And he immediately said, oh, we'll send them, I don't know, $100 or something. We'll send them. You know. And my first reaction was, why would he do that? You know, why would anybody want to do that? And right after that initial kind of reaction of mine was this very strong sense of inspiration from his little act of generosity. It wasn't even his money, probably. But it kind of resonated with something inside of me that made me feel very warm and happy and inspired by the idea of being generous, by generosity. So what resonates in our hearts? So traditionally for Buddhists, the triple refuge is that which causes your heart to resonate. Those best qualities within you, those qualities, the potential of peace, of freedom, of calm, of love, of compassion. The triple refuge don't just simply resonate with that potential within us, but they also resonate with that potential within us that says, I can do something about this. I can follow a path, I can engage myself in developing my awareness, developing my generosity, developing my ethics, developing my spiritual friendships, so that I could begin eradicating or uplifting or becoming free of self-centered delusions, self-centered greed and hate and fear. Triple refuge is then the orientation, represents the orientation to do that and the heartfelt inspiration to follow, to take those steps, to walk the path, to walk, gacchami, to walk for refuge in the Buddha is to walk on the path of practice. So, therefore, down through the ages, Buddhists have chanted, Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami. And then, to really make sure that it really comes from the depths of the heart, they say, for the second time, which in Pali is dutiyampi, dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. And then to really give it a chance to resonate with the deepest chords in your heart, they say it a third time, tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. And that's how it is. So do you have any questions or comments about any of that I'd like to ask? Yes?
There was a news report on Vibram Public Radio Friday, I think it was, from Saturday, that some thousands of Dalits who were untouchable caste in India were taken in some sort of mass ceremony to not the practice of Hinduism and make themselves Buddhist as a way of emerging from the caste system.
Right.
Did you hear about that? And you know if this is the ceremony of the Hindus?
Oh, yeah. I don't know, I didn't hear about the last one, but the only person that I know of who has the moral authority or stature to be critical of Mahatma Gandhi was a man by the name of Dr. Ambedkar, who lived in India in you know, kind of was contemporary to Mahatma Gandhi. And he came from the untouchable class of India. And so he was also kind of working, I think, for the liberation of India from the English, but he was also very concerned about the well-being of the untouchables. And with the independence of India, this became even more important for him, and he had some disagreements with Gandhi, that Gandhi wasn't doing enough for the untouchable class. And at some point, I don't know when it was, and I don't know my history that well, but he renounced Hinduism. He was kind of like a leader. He was a political leader in India for the untouchable class. So he was a very important person. And at some point, he renounced his Hinduism, and which was, I think, a big shock to many people. And then he said he was going to spend his time looking for a better religion for his people. And he spent a lot of years studying Christianity and Islam and Buddhism and different things. And he finally settled on Buddhism as being that the religion that would be most helpful to the untouchable class, the most one that would most help them pull them out of their oppressed state and their situation. So then in 1954, he took refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, which is often considered to be the defining ceremony for making someone a Buddhist. You don't have to consider yourself a Buddhist by taking refuge, but it's kind of the defining thing for some people. And then immediately he turned around, and either he gave it or he arranged for have it to be given to hundreds of thousands or millions, or a million and a half or something, of these untouchables in India. So in 1954, this huge number of people were converted to Buddhism. And then down through this decade since then, this ceremony has been done for many more untouchables. And Buddhism pretty much died out in India around the 14th century. And so this was kind of a reestablishment of Buddhism in its original homeland. And for many years, most Buddhists in the world didn't pay any attention to them, ignored them, and they were very poor people. And they didn't have a background in Buddhism, so they didn't have a lot of Buddhist teachers of their own. And the only group that I know of who has really taken them under, really made a big effort to try to help and support and teach, bring Buddhism to this particular class of Indian Buddhists, is a group of English Buddhists, mostly English, called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, who have done a lot of work, social work and AIDS work and Dharma work for these people. Yes?
You know, first word I thought of when you said refuge was retreat, and I'm kind of wondering if there's a connection between taking a retreat and taking refuge. I know, and also the Buddhist teachings on one retreat practice. Is there a connection, is there a relationship between the refuges and a retreat experience? Or am I just trying
well,
to connect?
No, it's a reasonable thing. Most obviously, at the beginning of most retreats that we teach, or all the retreats we teach, at Spirit Rock, for example, there's a we take refuge. It's the opening ceremony of the retreat, and the refuge ceremony is more than just taking the triple refuge. It goes hand in hand with taking the five precepts. That you wouldn't do the two separately; you do both of them together. So that happens at the opening of a retreat. So I think for some people, going on retreat is a time to really try to follow through as thoroughly as they can with going for refuge. It's orientation that is so important for their life. They're really going to try to put it in practice as thoroughly as they can. They're in an environment which is a Buddhist environment, a practice environment. They're with other people who are practicing. So it feels like kind of a real boost to one's path, one's practice, one's inspiration. And in terms of, you know, taking refuge in Sangha, it's invaluable to do it together with other people who are doing the same thing and involved with it as seriously as they are in retreat. What you don't want is to have, though, is the notion that the only place you can go for refuge is on retreat. Refuge is an issue that applies to all your life. It has to do with orientation by which you live your life, the central orientation, the values in which you hold. And they're as valuable on retreat as outside. Peggy.
I'm not quite sure how to formulate this. with all these events that are happening in the world today, sometimes it's helpful for me, and maybe is this going for refuge? It helps me to say certain things are not available to me because of this practice, or because I truly believe in the value of this practice and the teachings and the way of the Buddha. It's certain actions, certain ways of being in the world are not available. I just say, that is not where I can go. Sort of like maybe the Dalai Lama saying, we don't kill any living beings because we know
right. What
it would be like. We know how we feel about life, and so we can't kill another living being. So if I say that is not part of my repertoire to kill other people, to go and kill other people, it's like it feels to me like I go for refuge. I take refuge. It is like a place that I have that's there that supports me in a practice that says this is not a possibility. Therefore, I must look elsewhere. And so then the practice becomes looking elsewhere, going through the difficulties, when it would be so much easier for me to say, I'm going to just cut off my heart to these people. I'm going to assume these people have no value or can't be rehabilitated or whatever. There's nothing more to do with them than to kill them. If that's not a possibility for me, it means I have to work harder and I have to deal with my fear that I could get killed because of that belief or because of that action or that I could put other people that I love in danger or whatever, but then I have to deal with all that. But what the refuge is for me is that I have this whole thing behind me, or I put my faith in it or something. Mm-hmm. That's where I put it.
Yeah.
I don't know,
oh, very well. You've been very eloquent. It's very beautiful. I appreciate it very much.
It's hard. It's easy. In a funny way, for me, it's easier to do it with Osama bin Laden and the Afghans than it is for me to do it with Bush. And but as a congressman, I find it easier for me to go to the hatred or to the anger. But I guess that came up today, and I realized that's another place I have to do it.
Yeah. So as I said last Monday, the Buddha said it isn't just simply you should avoid killing, but one of the places you shouldn't go is to hate.
Right.
And hate is outside of what's healthy or wholesome . And so then the question is, but Buddhists certainly hate. So it isn't that, but Buddhists certainly have hate, because unless you're a Buddha. But the commitment then is to work with that, maybe not to give into it.
That becomes
the practice, and to do that in a wise way, not to beat yourself up or feel guilt for its presence, but to see it as something that's workable and manageable, and something you can practice with.
So one of the things that I was talking to a friend about this, because we're really trying to talk to each other and support each other to find things that we feel can be helpful in the world today. Healing in the world today, that if we're not going to go to war, if war is not the possibility, or hatred or anger. And one of the things we came up with today was a loving kindness practice. We were thinking one of the things she's doing is even compassionate listening with Congress people, but also a loving kindness practice for our Congress people. And for our president and for our Rumsfeld, loving kindness practice for these people. So I just want to put that out.
Yeah, it's important. It's very.
Ask for help or refuge from my sangha for that practice as well.
It's a very important practice. Thank you. Yes, please.
I liked your analogy about the linoleum floor. I was just going to say, I think she kind of talked about it in my head, but you know how, like, when you clean the floor, And somebody walks on it. It's like, how do we deal with the problem of, like, I mean, the metaphor is like, you know, you can have all the practice in the world and then you're living in the world and stuff happens to dirty floor.
Yeah. That's out of your control. But see, people have come along and dirty the floor. That's for sure. But there's certain things, you know, like in Solo Valley, they have these parties and you show up sometimes and the place has all the sticky beer on the floor, you know. And when the beer is there, then the dirt really stays and stuck, you know, for a long time. So you know, people come along and, you know, dirty your floor. But the beer that's going to really get you stuck and really make it hard to get off is how you relate to that. And if you don't bring any beer along, then I think at some point the winds will just kind of blow it away. Good last one.
Meaning that I don't listen to this mass media, so I keep everything shut down from my world. But since I am very far away from connecting to my within, it is very isolating and very lonely. So I feel that I cannot reach out to read a piece of, you know, an article and write a critique about it or demonstrate, you know, against it. But at the same time, it's quite isolating.
So maybe, you know, you should start in small steps, and rather than reach out to the world far away, reach out to your neighbor, and let your neighbor reach into you, and then it grows from there. The refuges are traditionally called three refuges, as I've talked about this evening. Occasionally, they're talked about that there's four refuges. And the fourth, the additional one, is said to be yourself. Take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and the Sangha, and take refuge in yourself. That you yourself can be your own light, you yourself can be your own island of support. That you yourself can be your own best friend, your own support, your own teacher. Since you have to do the work yourself anyway, take refuge in oneself is to believe in oneself, that oneself can make a difference, and that one can do the work. And you don't have to be isolated in yourself forever, but you can do the work and be engaged and do this and make a difference. So thank you very much. And if you didn't like this talk, leave it here.